I'd love to take a moment to allow each speaker to just offer context about what their organization does, who they are, and then we'll proceed from there.
My name is Benjamin. I use he, they pronouns. I work at Sisters of the Road. I've been there for about a little over a year and a half. And I'm with the Western Regional Advocacy Project for about 6 years. So Sisters of the Road is a low-income cafe in downtown on 6th and Davis, Northwest. It's been there since 1979, giving people good, delicious food for relatively cheap to free or for a barter in trade. Our entrees are $1.25. The principal reason why I like Sisters of the Road, though, is because it's about organizing power in the community. It's about giving community to those without neighbors or are treated like they're not neighbors. For people that are working as hard as they can in the area, that live in the area, that just don't have the means to provide for themselves, or houseless folks, or really anybody that doesn't have a lot of money, or they're just really wanting some food. Yeah, it's great. I love it. I don't know. Yeah. Oh, and RAP is a coalition of sorts of homeless advocacy, homeless-led houseless groups along the West Coast, principally in Colorado, California, and Oregon. And it's been around for about 15 years. We tend to deconstruct the systemic issues around homelessness, including who and what is applying that pressure to keep people in poverty. And yeah, that's the basics of it.
My name is Teresa. I founded Don't Shoot Portland. It was in response to not only the death of my nephew who got killed on Northwest 2nd and Cooch on September 26th of 2010, but also in response to the uprising of the murder of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. I started my organization and really organizing and becoming an advocate and an activist after my nephew's death, because since it was gang-related or gun-related, there was no first responders that would save his life, and they didn't allow medical response. And so those two things made me think, like, whoa, there's a lot of unsolved homicides in our community. There's a lot of lack of resources to stop the violence, but yet and still there's millions of dollars coming in because of the violence. So in my opinion, as someone who has lost several family members here in the city, I felt like it was like racketeering, some kind of hustle, corruption. And so I started participating and attending these meetings and going to different committees and boards and attending CRC meetings and different angles of community involvement that were surrounding the efforts of community policing and community engagement. And all of it looked extremely criminal and corrupt and discriminatory. And all the policymakers and all of the petitioners of policy and information and engagement are a part of this hustle. And I think we call it community policing. I call it racketeering, criminal negligence, political agendas, all that. And so I'm just thankful to be here today, because being able to have research and audits and information to substantiate the interest of safe communities for people that have been harmed in gun violence is necessary, and to remove that critical, corrupt part that eliminates our opportunity to seek justice or to get answers is important, and no one's helping us. So thank you, CR, and everybody else that's here. Thank you.
It's always an honor to get to follow Teresa at any type of event. Hi, my name is Lilith Sinclair. I'm here representing DCRIM Oregon, which is a newly found group and coalition centered around fighting for the decriminalization, decarceration, and destigmatization of sex work in all its forms here, starting in Portland, expanding throughout the state, and hopefully helping to expand that effort moving across the country. A few of the key tenets that we find our organizing and our principality is based around is intersectionality, right? And all of the ways that means. That means centering the most marginalized and analyzing the ways that they face multiple different forms of oppression, and also applying that to the oppression that they face under capitalism, under a police state, because of the illegality of sex work as it stands. And so we are consistently reaffirming that we are a prison abolitionist group, that we are anti-capitalist, that we are anti-police state and in support of the abolition of the police state as we know it. And so for us, a big part of the work that we do and a big part of the work that we're centered around is the recognition of the ways that the current system of illegal sex work makes us further at risk to be dealt violence from the state. And a lot of the organizing that happens around sex work through the state and with support of large funders up until this point has been done from an anti-sex trafficking standpoint, right? And so what we want to do is we want to take that narrative and shift it and help people to understand that sex trafficking is a piece of human trafficking. And within the larger bucket of human trafficking, like, this isn't even something that hits like the top most damaging statistics in regards to like how frequently people are dealing with trafficking and abuse through those systems. So we want to recognize that decriminalization will work in the same way that ending the prohibition of alcohol will, in recognizing that like when we stop pushing sex workers under the table and into the back alleys, we create avenues for them to be seen and for us to organize for safety amongst ourselves and separate from the state, because that's so necessary. So that's a little bit about Decrim Oregon.
Hi everyone, my name is Corey Lita and I am a organizer and chapter member of Critical Resistance Portland, as well as Care Not Cops. You've heard a little bit about Care Not Cops today, so I won't go into full length there, but I will say that this has been a campaign that has been building since 2015 and was formally launched in 2017 and was ignited by the work of community sessions that Critical Resistance held throughout the years. And so it is a campaign and also a coalition of individuals and groups and organizations in our community, and we encourage folks to think about how you could see yourself as part of that coalition. And so we, as Olivia, you know, spoke to, really did start thinking about this through the lens of mental health and first responders. And I think the reason why I am so excited to be doing the work today is that I think what we did was really built off of a really important narrative of self-determination and what it means to be clearly articulating why we know that police and policing can never really provide for us what we need when we need it. And so now being able to really focus in on gang policing and how that specifically operates within Portland, I think allows us to really talk about the ways in which policing has always been and will always be anti-Black, and how that then is part of the landscape of Portland being, you know, one of the whitest cities in America, and also one of the places where Black and brown communities are targeted so heavily by the police. And so one of the ways I think that we have really narrowed in on what is possible in the campaign is thinking about this arm of police, which is gang policing. So I think that still really is centered around self-determination. I think that is still centered around what our community needs. And I think we all can recognize that targeting people for this idea of violence or the perception of capable violence will never get us free. And policing will never be part of that. And I'm excited to be doing this work and sharing more about it today with you all.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. To hopefully keep everyone on the same page, we have a list of general questions I'll offer to the panel. But as they offer their explanations, please feel free to write down questions, because we do want to have opportunity for Q&A. To kick this off then, let's talk about specifically what are ways these different organizations experience policing? And the second part of the question are what are ways to actually support practical community endeavors to minimize the interaction, indeed, or any contact with policing and punitive and the legal system?
Should I start?
You
lock it?
It's open.
I don't want it. So, I principally work with unhoused folks in downtown, in Old Town. It is intense over there. Their contact with the police is probably pretty daily, if not multiple times a day. Harassment from the police is pretty big, telling them to move on, to leave areas, can't be here, yada yada. Arresting folks, taking their property. I'm sure most of you are familiar with these narratives. It is very unfortunate. I think 52% as of a few years ago were all the arrests in Portland, 52% were houseless folks or people that didn't have an address listed. That's a lot for only being like 3% of the population, something like that. So it's very clear to me that the mayor or the police are directly targeting the houseless, being very, very vicious about it. There's very few cities that have that kind of arrest percentage. It's kind of whack, actually. Just recently, I think a few days ago, he was in LA with the mayor of LA talking about how compassionate Portland is, how progressive they are, and how other cities can really adopt and model their methods after them. And really what that's about is how we do not target people, we target behaviors, we target cleanliness, we target the trash on the sidewalk. It has nothing to do with people sleeping. That's not the issue, right? And so our administration has been able to go around like the Boise versus Bell situation in Idaho, where they banned or they made it unconstitutional to arrest people for sleeping outdoors. So anyways, the police are all over the houseless community. It's very unfortunate. Some of the ways we've been trying to mitigate that is by doing like Know Your Rights trainings, liaisoning with NLG and other groups to be able to work out some strategies for people, giving information shares, doing the occasional workshop for people on the streets. But it is really difficult to get the police to not be snooping around campsites. That's it.
Some of the ways we do work, the people that are targeted obviously in our community are black and brown people, and they're targeted through our education system, through our health systems, through our housing systems, through our parks and recreation. Just this morning I got a call from a mother in Oregon City where I do a lot of advocacy, because in 1 year there were 10 children that committed suicide that were like in high school or younger, just in that school district. But the mom's child killed himself a month ago, and right now she needed to contact us for legal access, because now the school district is retaliating against her to take away her other children, because obviously there's something happening at home, even though it was documented in all of the issues that were happening with him, that he was being bullied in the school and that the school district wasn't helping him. The referral came from the police, of course, just like a lot of the referrals for the families that I advocate for. When we get public records requests to find out what we can get as far as documentation of their interest in dealing with an issue around discrimination or violence, it usually has information in there where someone has referred them to the police for more information or to look in on the children or the family's household. And so they're clearly using social services and the interest of access against people that they don't believe deserve that access or do not have the opportunity to advocate for themselves. And so in seeing this, and another example of one-sided criminalization because of these issues, I was in court yesterday as my friend Demetra Hester was testifying, and after her testimony, we had a police officer that was called to TriMet on the night that she was attacked by Jeremy Christian. And he talked and testified to the fact that even though he knew who Jeremy was and knew him as a known Nazi or white nationalist, that he did not check the box for bias, even though the call included that there were racial slurs, and that he also did not check the box for, it was bias and gang. And even though we say that we see the white nationalists and the KKK and all of these different agencies as gangs, neither one of those boxes were checked for Jeremy, and he was also allowed to leave the scene as they interrogated the black woman who he had smashed in the face with a Gatorade bottle the night before he killed two people on the MAX train. And so in Portland, when we talk about having access to policing and community, for all of the money that they spend in our communities to police us, it's very rare to be able to call them for any kind of access to justice. I deal with a lot of families that need advocacy for domestic violence, and they know they can't call the police, whether it's their children or a loved one that they're having this issue with, because there's things that will happen to them to criminalize their existence for making those calls. And so when we talk about the value of that asset for the city, there is no value in the asset except for to oppress people and to document and to create files and profiles against people that they consider to be second-class citizens. So what we did in response to that, we used to do a lot of protesting and advocating. I used to attend a lot of events and testify a lot, but it became a targeting thing because there weren't any elected leaders or any of the social agencies coming to protect my safety because I was speaking out. So the retaliation gets even bigger when you're also marginalized. So the response was to start a legal referral service in our community for the community, which includes workshops and training on everything from housing discrimination to sexual violence, which is happening a lot within our school systems and our housing and all these different agencies that don't respond. But that's been an asset that we're trying to connect and develop for community, and that's open for anyone who has those needs, because we know that filing a police report actually does not lead to justice for a lot of us. And so getting lawyers on the front end to help file complaints, that does work.
So when we talk about the ways that sex workers interact with police violence and how we experience policing, there is a need to sort of break it down, because the reality is that just like within so many other larger communities, right, like more marginalized and multi-marginalized peoples experience violence and policing in different ways. And so just as a brief like insulation, a little bit of education. So like when we talk about sex work, right, we're talking about a broad bucket. We're talking about full service sex work, what might be commonly referred to in legislature as prostitution, which is a slur that people who are not sex workers should not use. We are also talking about strippers, right, which is like, that's like the two ends of the spectrum in regards to safety. Like full service sex workers tend to be engaging in work that, because of the nature of the work and it because it is explicitly criminalized, has an increased level of danger. And then you look at stripping, right, which is technically legal, but is still criminalized under different legislature on honestly like a state by state and city by city level. And so there are varying levels at which we engage in this. However, that being said, a few examples of the ways that we experience policing are direct targeting from the police in regards to street-based sex workers, which often tend to be our black, trans, women comrades. This type of targeting is literally like, they talk about, there's been a lot of talk about how, and I wanna say it's DC, there is a law that essentially allows for targeting black, trans women for being black, trans women, because they know that like black, trans women are often street-based sex workers. And so there's a lot of work around fighting against this legislature, which essentially allows for a level of targeting for walking while trans, right? And so like this is one example of the ways that people experience policing. That also gets expanded from the individual level, and a lot of different police agencies across the country engage in things called stings. And this leads back to that little bit of background I wanted to give when I was introducing Decrim Oregon, and we talk about the ways that people weaponize the fight against sex trafficking as nothing but a means to further criminalize and push against consensual adult sex work. And so there's a lot of intentional muddying of those terms. And so what the police like to do is they like to say, like, oh, we've been doing an investigation on a sex trafficking ring that operates out of this hotel. And in reality, it's just one of the hotels that is accessible for sex workers to be able to book clients out of, and they end up making arrests and publicizing the names, legal names and faces of a ton of sex workers and their clients. And they say, they publicize it in the media and they go like, oh, we've saved all these women. And in reality, what they've done is taken all of these people that they've arrested, thrown them into jail, and they often face varying levels of charges. There's no level of approaching it through a way of, even if it were, which it's not, I want to be clear, even if it were about fighting sex trafficking and helping these victims. And when they do, by chance, end up interacting with sex trafficking victims, they're also being processed in the exact same way that sex workers are, in which they're being thrown into jails and stuck with charges and having their names and faces publicized across the news, which results in a whole host of issues being outed as a sex worker in regards to the ways that we deal with stigmatization. So it's a multi-leveled form of state violence, which is infused with all the other different types of violence that we see. That's not even to mention the fact that in addition to this, like, stings happen in strip clubs as well. As I mentioned, there's different legislature that allows for different types of engagement in the strip club world. For example, a lot of us are familiar with Portland stripping, which has some of the most lax laws because nudity is protected under obscenity laws here in Portland. But in some other states, for instance, in certain municipalities, they have literal code that says, like, you cannot be in the strip club unless you wear three pairs of underwear at least this many millimeters thick. And if you don't, if you're wearing two, they can come in and stick you with a prostitution charge or an obscenity charge. And so they do stings of these natures in strip clubs as well. So you see police violence at all levels of engagement in the sex industry. However, when we're talking about the severity of it, we circle back to the targeting of, like, Black trans women, street workers, full service sex workers, and these are the people who are experiencing a lot more frequent explicit violence. When we talk about explicit violence, I mean, we're talking about, like, murder, sexual and physical assault, the whole gambit of direct violence from police officers who are extorting workers for their services, who are expressing violence against these people because they know that violence against us is largely excused across much of the country and through so many facets of life. So those are some of the multitude of ways that we experience, the communities that we engage with experience policing. There's more, but it would take a long time to list and explain. But some of the ways that we're fighting against this is, like, really through this large scale push for community education and for a change in legislature, which decriminalizes prostitution, sex work, full service sex work. Essentially, what this does is eliminate the ability for cops to hide behind the law to be able to target adults engaging in survival under capitalism how they see fit, right? What this does is allow for us to be able to create avenues where we can communicate amongst ourselves and create and work on creating autonomous individual systems of support, safety, and security for and by and amongst sex workers without having to deal with being criminalized under laws that are in place, which not only allow for, like, the act of sex work, the exchange of sex for goods, services, or finances to be criminalized, but also they have laws in place in a lot of different parts of the country which essentially are intentionally vague in the way that they describe what, like, pimps are, right? Or how they describe people who are engaging in purporting a trafficking endeavor. So essentially, there's a whole other level of threatening other sex workers or even the people who are close to us in our lives with kind of, like, ratting us out or, like, hey, you took money from them once after they got that money from sex work, that makes you their pimp. Like, oh, you paid your babysitter with money that you earned from sex work. That makes you complicit. And so there are a lot of different layers to which sex workers are policed, and it's about envisioning the ways that we can fight against that legislator, eliminate some of that legal code that allows for us to protect people who are being coerced, who are dealing with trafficking, who are in a different position and need different types of laws to protect them, and keeping that sort of language while also striking all language that criminalizes the consensual engagement of sex work in all its forms of adults.
So I think it might be helpful to talk a little bit about the gang enforcement team and the gun violence reduction team. So how many folks feel like they're fairly familiar with both, just out of curiosity? Okay, so Portland Police has historically had a team, a part of the police force called the gang enforcement team. And so that was specifically about gang designation. And so it was a way to designate certain members of our community, specifically Black and Brown folks, as being gang affiliated and therefore deserving of and part of increased policing. Supposedly the city ended that team. They've said that they've ended the team, they've announced that they've ended the team. None of that is true. Instead, they created a new team called the Gun Violence Reduction Team. The majority of that team is focused on gang affiliated policing. And so there's other like pieces of that team that like are supposed to be about like survivors of gun violence and, you know, gun violence that's connected to relationship violence. But we know that it really is a very savvy and strategic move by the city to talk about gun violence instead of gang enforcement, right? It like makes it sound like we're trying to like end this thing in the city that's like scary and hard and that we need police. But it is a very, we have to look at these things and be critical of like why they're called what they are, right? Like it is easy for us to be like gang enforcement team, like that's, you know, that's more easy to critique, but a gun violence reduction team is a little bit harder. So I share that because I think that what we're up against in this work and who is impacted by this work is all of us, right? Like all of us are impacted by policing in Portland. Which is part of the reason why our coalition is really about like bringing any and all of us together. But we're specifically looking at gun violence, the gun violence reduction team, gang enforcement team, and policing as the people that we know are most impacted in our city. So the other thing I'll name about that too is that, you know, we're in a city that is 6% Black, and yet nearly 70% of those gang-affiliated arrests were Black folks. And so, you know, whether or not regardless of our feelings about gangs, we know that there is direct evidence that the city of Portland is policing and targeting Black folks in our community. And there is still a gang-affiliated, like active gang-affiliated list that the city uses. They claim that it's not true, but it is. And so that's the other thing is like, police are gonna tell us a lot of things, right? But we also can look at what the community is telling us, that people are still being actively listed and targeted for policing. And I think it also gets a little muddier too as like more and more gentrification happens, people are getting pushed into other counties. And so I think another conversation we could have is like, how do we look at our region when it involves Black and Brown folks and not just like Multnomah County policing, because I think that we would even have more stark numbers if we were to really look at that, right? So I think the thing that we really are trying to do within our work is think about how do we do the work that has those most impacted in leadership and do the work that really addresses, I think, two different things. One, those most impacted having the resources and self-determination to be able to move through, you know, living here in Portland with the least amount of impact by policing. I think the other side of that is how do we, as folks who, you know, I'll speak for myself as like, you know, someone who's a light-skinned Latinx person, I'm policed less than someone else, potentially. And so what is my role and responsibility to engage with policing at all to impact those who are policed. Meaning, like, how do I not call the cops on other people, right? How do I not view other folks as dangerous or deserving of policing? So I think it's both sides, right? It's like, how do those most impacted have the resources we need to move through living here? And also, how are those who are the most commonly going to access policing to target others really have that public education piece to shift out of that? And I think that's challenging because we really do live in a culture that wants us to be calling the cops on each other and viewing like accountability and responsibility and first response as somebody else's problem. And our work is directly calling into question that logic and really the logic of policing in general. And if we really sit down and think about it, there is no logic of policing, right? Like, it doesn't make sense if you put two and two together. And we've been taught that, you know, that it does. And that does require a lot of unlearning. So I think that's like public education, resource building, self-determination, leadership by those most impacted, and I think coalition. And I want to just stress that, like, we really do believe that coalitional organizing is one of the critical pieces to do this kind of work. So.
Thank y'all. Thank mm-hmm. y'all. That was so much. One of the conversations we're hoping to have is taking a look at this gun violence reduction team. And it was noted earlier that that costs the city $6 to $7 million a year. How would your organization or campaign utilize those funds if you had an opportunity to invest in people and not policing?
So in the audits that we utilize, not only the ones through Multnomah County's Red Foundation, the MacArthur Red Foundation, showing the overrepresentation of black people in jail, in foster care, committing suicide, in our health department as a partner and resource, the biggest issue is the displacement in our communities. And so if they really wanted to lessen the opportunity to police people, the money that they're putting into the gang violence or the gun violence reduction, those services would center around housing community members because the most vulnerable community members are also those same people that are being over-policed. And there is no safety net for a transition of children that have been displaced or taken away from their families when they're coming out of our foster care system. And I grew up in foster care, and when you turn 18 years old, you're literally put out on the street with a garbage bag with your belongings in it, along with a whole generation of children that are also displaced. And there's no plan or service or social alignment with stability for housing, education, or anything else. And the fact that we're being policed up until our 18th birthday as juveniles or whatever they want to call us in the criminal element, there's never a positioning for success. In the time that we were in school when they first started the gang task force, they immediately eliminated our Parks Bureau programming. And so when I went to DCJC, which is where they have juvenile justice meetings, they said that at that time, the Parks programming were providing food and services to kids and a place for them. But when they cut those services, 70% of the students that used to show up for those programs did not come into the parks anymore. And they also had an increase of 30% of people that occupy juvenile beds in their detention centers immediately. And so the children that didn't go to the parks for services, if they were walking to the library, if they were going to the mall, if they were walking around their neighborhood, they were being policed for not being in the park. And then what we've seen in the 2000s is that they're actually being policed in the parks because now we have park rangers to check them out and to make sure that they're not committing crimes and things like that. And so housing would be the biggest necessity because once you have that, there's security for you, and we don't have that. And it's a shame. There's a lot of things, layers that are missing in that, but housing is gonna be the most essential. Our community got displaced. It became illegal to live with relatives because, again, in the Portland Housing Bureau, a lot of people that are marginalized are on Section 8 vouchers, which means that you can't have people living in your house that aren't on the lease. And a lot of times, if they have any criminal record, they can't live with you. That includes your children. That includes your brothers and sisters. That includes your parents. It's ridiculous. and is very targeted. And because of the relationship in community policing, those referrals come from every sector of social service. So again, if our housing was more available and was less discriminatory and less inclusive with all those agencies, I think we would have better sustainability for people in our community.
So for people on the streets, for houseless folks, there's a lot of things that can be done, and not a lot of space to do it. So if there was like 6 to 7 million just being thrown around, I think some of the big things that the city could already be doing, and kind of are, sort of, would be things like tiny home villages, autonomous tiny home villages. So a bit different from the Kittens Women's Village model, where it's very top-down and nonprofit oriented, but rather more like the Right to Dream 2 model or Dignity Village, where everything's horizontal, and the tribe or the village itself makes its own rules and governs itself. Things like hygiene facilities around downtown corridors, or really everywhere from 82nd to St. John's and beyond. Storage facilities. So there's like two in the city, and they cost a lot. I think they're like $30,000 a month or something, just for a shipping crate in downtown and over by Hazelnut Grove, the tiny house village, which is ridiculous just to put a piece of metal on the ground. Safe camping sites and safe parking sites around town. I mean, these things would cost so little to maintain. It's essentially a parking lot. Peer-run security services, so like security teams made up of houseless folks who are able to provide and care for the safety of those on the streets. Often when we talk about livability, which I hate that word, livability is a pretty discriminatory term that relates to how livable is it for me, a privileged person with a house, to be able to tolerate the aesthetics of the streets. Mm-hmm. That's what livability is, or that's how it's used pretty often, which I really hate. But what about the livability of those on the streets who are often targeted by predators, targeted by vigilantes, targeted by police, targeted by angry, drunk bar patrons, mm-hmm. And everything else in between? People just trying to bully people. So being able to create self-defense teams or something around that idea without it being two cops, maybe horizontal. My philosophy on police is that if we abolish police, that would lead towards everybody being a cop, which I know that sounds antithetical. But if everybody's on security, it's even, right? It's equal. We all take care of each other. But let me not go into that. it's a whole different thing. And trash pickup services. So peer-run trash pickup, it's already happening around town. Sort of due to several different things. I guess I should talk about the Compassionate Change District, which is a group I founded, co-founded about 2 years ago, which provided a list of alternatives to the enhanced service districts. So it's going to get a little wordy. Enhanced service districts are these entities that are paid for by property managers using public tax dollars that the city then gives to the nonprofit, not private entities, or private public partnership entities. So an example of it is Clean and Safe. Now, Clean and Safe, on the outside, seems great, except that they are half comprised of a private police force that is not accountable to any agency in the city, except maybe the police, who they report to once a month, but those meetings are not disclosed, nor can we get minutes from it. And so they kind of just do whatever they want and can harass the houseless with impunity. If you want to make a report, guess who you report to? The Portland Business Alliance, which is definitely in the support of the houseless, right? So there's a lot of issues around that there's so much money in the pot towards policing the houseless that if it was redistributed, it would greatly impact our entire city in a beneficial way. And so I hope we are able to develop stratagems to make that happen over the course of forever? I don't know. Course of the next year. Yeah.
I want to just gently interrupt and make sure I can keep us on time. There's been just a wealth of information shared, and I want to give the audience an opportunity to offer any Q&A before we transition into potentially the next phase of today's event?
So after we answer Q&A?
Yes.
I'll keep it brief. So at Decrim, like, we want to recognize the importance of building off of all these things, right? Like, I have this list of things I also could have expanded upon, but I don't need to because a lot of it's already been said. In regards to housing resources, like actual fair, equitable housing resources, that's so important. So many sex workers have unstable housing because of the way that stigmatization affects our access to housing. Most sex workers I know deal with unstable housing. So that's a big one. And it is, like I said, one of those intersectional issues that affects so many different communities, and part of the reason why that, like, coalition building is so important. We also would support youth programming and talking about, like, how we do, like, peer-led security and things like that. That's essentially, like, what we're talking about when we talk about, like, autonomous organizing amongst ourselves. Something that is, like, a necessity for how we continue to engage down a path that would be, I think a worthwhile way to redistribute some of those funds is reserving a small amount of it to actually be able to do, like, a competent, like, peer-guided study, an anonymous study on the actual conditions of sex work in Oregon. A lot of these things don't exist. We're working off of communication within and amongst ourselves, but these things don't always paint the most accurate picture. We can only do so much in fixing issues until we see, like, with full clarity what the issue is. And then the last point is, some of that money would be really well spent being redirected to different peer-led groups that are doing work around, like, harm reduction, records expungement, and the different things that make gaining access to some of these other resources a little bit more feasible when you can get, like, your records expunged, or when you are able to be given resources for harm reduction while also being able to live in a way that is not being further stigmatized because of how you engage in life.
Yeah, I mean, I think if the question is, like, what could we spend, you know, $7 million a year on instead of this gang, you know, this gun violence reduction team, I mean, not to sound flippant, but I really believe, like, anything else. Like, you know, like, really anything else. Like, anything else that's, like, really about community self-determination and resourcing ourselves, like, would be better, you know? Yeah, I think for me, I think about it, like, my kind of language for it is, like, stability resources, like, anything that's going to help someone have more stability in their life, however they self-determine that, right? Like, if that's having access to regular Narcan, that's a stability resource. Mm-hmm. If it's, you know, not necessarily having stable housing, but having the fluidity to move housing as needed, like, that's a stability resource. And so I think that that is what we all get to decide for ourselves. And I think there's different ways of going about that that could cost money, right? Like, public education that allows us to feel equipped to be able to support each other in crisis, like, that could cost money and time. I also think that there's a way to support each other and resource our community so that we're able to participate in things like participatory budgeting processes that would allow us to actually do this work together. And I think back to last year's budget cycle where, you know, we were calling for a $6 million reduction in policing while the city was literally cutting $6 million from community centers and pools in the city. And it just seems like really there's every year there's groups that are begging for money from the city to keep just the bare minimum open. And you know, I think we already have a long list of where that money could go. We wouldn't even need to, like, brainstorm, right? Like, we have people who are asking for money. And I want to point out Opal, who's in the room today, who also, you know, has been doing work around TriMet and specifically, like, the Yeja group that has been calling for, like, you know, covering the cost of TriMet passes for youth. I mean, like, think about how quickly people get criminalized as young people for riding the bus without paying, or perception of riding the bus without paying. And what could that really do if we took $6 million, $7 million, and paid for the cost of TriMet for everyone in the city? I don't think that we have to get that creative to realize that there are so many other options that we could put that money on, that any of them would be better than the police.
Thank you. Thank you. love to open this up to the audience. At a minimum, please let the organizations know who your question is steered towards, or if it's for everyone, please feel free to let them know as well. We definitely want to take some time to take audience questions.
Don't be shy, y'all.
I do have one other question. So I want to give everyone the same amount of freedom here. But we do have, you know, upcoming elections. You know, the mayor, two city seats, city council seats. What are ways our organizations can hold candidates and elected officials accountable while also being aware of the limitations of, you know, leaning on city governance?
Oh,
great.
So, just for the record, I'm running for office for mayor for the city. Yay. The primary election is on the May 19th, and the reason that I'm running now is because over the last 10 years, we've mobilized the community, and we've had a lot of wins. We've engineered a lot of community education, a lot of outreach, and for me, this is a return on investment for the organizing community. Because we don't have to protest and resist them when they're supposed to work for us. And the determination to get that out of public office, out of our public servants, has created a very hostile situation for a lot of us. We're dealing with the trauma and the abuse and the violence that's been perpetrated on us as taxpayers, as community members that have gone to them to petition them on several issues that have been discussed here today. And to be recipients of violence and to have documented that violence and to continue to be consistent in building community around these important issues, I believe that we've finished the decade of trauma and it's time to renew our opportunities to see the world differently. And so by putting myself in a position as a public servant, because we have so many community members in the community, we ended up getting like 600 people to sign up as volunteers. And so the plan now is to achieve what that looks like on May 19th in the respectful situation of the election. But then utilizing the win and looking at the next couple of months after that, from May 19th all the way up until January 21st, community organizers will have a very methodical opportunity to reconstruct what Cortland City Hall looks like. And that's in all of those facets, because all we have to do is get the win, but we get to administer that situation for 4 years, and then we get to do it for another 8 years. So what does that dismantling look like? What does the contributions from all these organizations, what would that look like if we eliminated the patriarchy that's using bureaucracy to stop us from having change? So I hope to see everybody at the polls. A lot of anarchists and community organizers that usually don't vote, we need your votes. We need you to go out in the community. We need you to facilitate the practice of community engagement. And it's time for real change, and this is our year. We can go in and take away these policing partnerships. We can participate in the collective bargaining. We can resist the bargaining with the union until they dismantle the union. A couple of years ago, before Donald Trump was the president, we had went to the police union and we held a protest there, and we learned about the collective bargaining agreement, and we saw the legitimate relationship between them and the arbitrator and how they utilized their commission power against us and the needs that we have, how it was just the line item that stopped them from making sure that the things that we were asking and demanding were taken care of. So we know that they're not helping us. The fact that the budget has increased, what that lets you know is that there are people that are sitting on the council right now that are probably gonna be running for re-election, and they need the police union's endorsement and they want their money. I don't want any of it. I don't want it to exist anymore. I don't think that it's appropriate. I don't think that city and public officials or people that are employed by the city should be able to kill the people that live in the city. So we have to take that line item out of there, and it's going to take a political revolution, and it's going to have to be radical. So,
yeah, I'll just add to that. that I think of all of it as like harm reduction. I don't actually like think of it as like a solution, like investing our time and energy into like who's going to be the mayor. I mean, I know Teresa will be a great mayor, but like, you know, I don't think any of it, like, and I'll speak for myself less than like CNC in this specific moment, but I think that we can hold clarity that who is in, who operates within these roles has immediate and direct impact on the decisions that get made about the city's money. And I think we can know that to be true, and I think we can make educated decisions about who we're voting for and who and what kind of questions that we're demanding those people running to answer, while also knowing that the roles themselves will never make us free, that like the city council will never be the answer to like liberatory, you know, our liberation and our ability to like move together for abolition. So that's why I call it harm reduction. I think we can take a harm reduction approach to it and be invested in that way without viewing it as the thing. And that may be the fact that I grew up as like an anarchist nihilist, but that would be the only way I could really approach it as harm reduction.
I think I want to add on to that because that was the beginning of what I wanted to say. Like I try to champion this understanding that like voting is harm reduction, and for people who even press back against that, I like to look at it as a way of saying like, hey, remember when we used to play like Sega and Nintendo 64 and like everyone was playing like Mario and like fighting against each other and you really wanted like the computer to be the weakest opponent? Like choose your opponent, choose the weakest opponent, like choose the person who's closest to you, who you have the best efforts or like the best ability to like push in a farther direction, right? Like it's one of the ways that we like following along and paying attention to, and I want to clarify that like I definitely am speaking a little bit more for myself right now. I don't want to put words necessarily in the mouth of Decrim Oregon as an organization, although this is the direction that we lean. There can be space saved for an understanding of recognizing voting as a form of harm reduction, as a form of being able to choose your opponent, and then recognizing that like once your opponent is chosen, there are a multitude of ways that you can engage with that, from the most liberal to the most radical, from the most arrestable to the least risk of arrest, right? Like it looks like maybe like engaging, like someone taking the time and energy to engage like the liberals of the city to say like, hey, call your elected officials and like demand accountability for them in this way, but also go to City Hall, and if you feel the need to express your opinions in person, like with a protest and a megaphone, do that. Like there are so many ways across the spectrum where you can impact the continued efforts to move one way or the other in regards to our candidates. And if that looks like putting forward a proposal for new legislation and championing around that and demanding that elected officials take a stance on whether or not they support this, like that's one way, right? So there's all these different ways that we can do harm reduction and that we can like organize for a little bit of breathing room on behalf of people in the city, so that once that little bit of breathing room is put in place, we have an opportunity to be able to help people engage in further more radical action working towards that abolition that we're hoping for.
So I do self-identify as an anarchist, but I have been telling everyone that votes to vote for Teresa. Which I encourage. I also look at it as harm reduction. I think Emma Goldman said if voting changed anything, they'd make it illegal, which is less applicable on the local levels. But engagement with politicians is tricky with me in particular because I used to lobby in Colorado for the Homeless Bill of Rights, which would decriminalize sleeping outdoors for the entire state. It's also a bill that's been run in Oregon and California as well. Lobbying was not fun. These people triple speak out three sides of their mouths. I didn't realize how insidious it can be. But I also realized that there are some politicians, one out of a million maybe, that actually do care and aren't ego driven. And they're very, very rare. Very rare. Luckily, there's one next to me. So I'm a big proponent of insider-outsider strategies. I think that in order to succeed in the future, that we need to know our city, deconstruct our city, and deconstruct power and authority in our city. So to me, the power very rarely lies with politicians directly. To me, I think the power lies with capital. And so in this city, entities like the Portland Business Alliance and entities like Travel Portland or whatever have tremendous amounts of power and influence over our city council. If you ever go to the auditor's office and look up letters that these entities have sent the mayor, like Mayor Hells, where they threaten him to sue him and all sorts of things over homeless issues, it's really quite an interesting dynamic to see the amount of pressure they constantly apply onto our city governance. And I think that our pathway to success is examining those relationships that they have with our politicians and then trying to break those linkages, circling them, triangulating them, and putting them in a position of vulnerability so that we have the leverage to make them do what they need to do. A little bit power politicky and somewhat reformist, because you do have to become in relation with these people, right? But I think it, in the long run, would be very effective if we were able to actually actively undermine the bankers and the Oregon real estate associations, the Portland Business Alliance, and business alliances all across the city associations that are actively undermining our ability to live here as brown people, as poor people, as trans people, as environmentalists, as people without housing, and do it out in the open all the time. The response is very minute because our attentions are often focused on polarizations of celebritism, like the mayor or like the president, which is fine, they are targets, but it is often the influence around them and the context of the environment that they're in that we need to destabilize, or that we need to examine, sorry. Not that I would not want to destabilize America, my favorite country.
Well, and I just want to say that I think the framework that CR uses and that I think is helpful here, and you may have heard us me talk about this before, which is like a reform versus an abolitionist reform. And so I just want to like plant the seed of thinking about that too if you haven't thought about it. So I think we can talk about like how can we move the city towards spending less money about police as like an abolitionist reform for me, because it's saying like we're still saying that that we recognize that that group has power and we're calling on them to make better decisions about where they're putting that money, which is chipping away at the greater prison industrial complex, even though at the end of the day, like, would we actually want a city council but instead of like participatory budgeting that is community led, right? So it's about that chipping away at something that will get us to that end goal as opposed to something that reinforces the power as legitimate. And so I think when we invest in these kinds of roles and do it in a way that doesn't reinforce their power as being legitimate or long-term what is needed or valued, then I think we're doing an abolitionist reform work around participating in these systems. And I think that distinction is important. As long as we're clear that the way we engage is for the greater end goal of abolition of the prison industrial complex, and I think we can engage. But when it becomes something that reifies it, I don't think we're actually doing the kind of work that's important. And we have worksheets that are big posters that Carly's posting right now that kind of showcases how to look at things from a reformist reform versus an abolitionist reform.
We'll take another moment just to ask if there are any questions.
Hey.
Awesome. We have a few hands. We'll start in the back.
My question is for Teresa, what is the best way to help support your campaign between now and the election?
Sign up to volunteer. I have amazing volunteers that are doing lead organizing work, and they can use the support. So go to the website, sign up, Teresa Rayford for Mayor.
What's
the
website?
Teresa Rayford for Mayor, pdx.org or .com. I have some information in my bag. I'll give it to you.
Mainly for Corey, elaborating on what you were saying to me, so I can process and understand, I guess. In the same way that like prison reform towards abolition is a goal for a lot of prison abolitionists because it makes things a little bit better, at the time. And the full abolition is a lot of work ahead. Are you talking about, in terms of anarchy and like local elections, for example, like this is kind of that type of thing, it's like reform towards anarchy. Would you say that that's like a similar type of thing?
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word anarchy because I don't personally use that framework myself anymore. But yes, what I'm saying is that I think we could say we should be challenging the people running for city council to hold better politics about policing and push them to know that if they were elected that they are going to be responsible to Portland's community demanding an end to policing and the police budget. So we can make those demands and we can say that's worth our time. As opposed to saying like it's not worth our time to engage with who's running and who's on the council at all because we know that the state will never make us free, right? So, you know, one is saying like let's not even engage at all, and I would argue that I think we can engage because there is power involved, and until we dismantle that power and redistribute it back to community, there can be a way for us to make demands and expect a response that will lead us towards something that will look like abolition, that is abolition. Does that clarify?
Yeah.
One more?
Yeah. This is for any of you. I think abolition work involves dismantling things as well as building things. And the police right now, they do perform some services, they supposedly perform some services, they're services that they perform just for people of privilege. And we've seen and heard even today some examples of what are ways to do those things or do those things better in a way that's not harmful. There's the street teams that came out of last year, and there was a mention of like, peer-led security teams. But I was wondering if anybody could mention some more ideas of what are things that we can build as we dismantle.
Some of the things, like, I think that it's already been stated, but I think the direct services to people without the criminalization effort, because a lot of the direct services, like food and shelter and all these other essentials, they also have you filling out information and checking boxes, and then they're doing these investigations behind you. And so in a lot of the city bureaus and the county bureaus, that quantification of data, because of where it's being sourced to, there's so much money involved in it that we forget to actually direct those services to people. And so we're literally collecting data from people that need the services. So I think that that's one of the biggest issues, is kind of like one of the things I want to do is audit the bureau relationships, stakeholder partners, community partners within the city to see like where are we exploiting information about our people. Rather than bringing in a provision of opportunity. So that's where we have to start, is re-examining those relationships and deconstructing those first because of the exploitation.
I'll be quick. I kind of brought that before, but to me, I think autonomous zones, autonomous temporary autonomous zones, although permanent, would be ideal in the future. So an example of that would be like Dignity Village, would be like Right to Dream 2, where they literally seized the land and held the ground, Hazelnut Grove as well. And they're the only villages except for Kitten that are in the city, although Agape's building. I think that those kinds of direct actions are needed. I think like in Oakland, the Oakland Moms for Housing, or they just took over a building squad of it, and you know, that was very powerful. Right to Dream 2 used to do that back in the day, although those are felonies, so can't last forever. But to me, that's the most powerful thing, because I'm not a big proponent of suggesting housing. Like, I think that if people were given the ability and the autonomy to provide for themselves, they would. They would go to the river and start building a house themselves. I think that we need to get to that level, that people need to have the freedoms to even express and provide for themselves before we, yeah. But, there's a large variety of solutions. Some are more impactful than others. But autonomous zones, to me, is probably the most impactful for helping people on the streets.
Yeah, so I want to add on to that. Something that I think I haven't quite heard in this conversation yet, and it might be because I showed up 10 minutes before the panel, so I'm just going to recognize that. But I think that when we're talking about things that we can build, right, there's something that we need to talk about in regards to, like, community building, which is really looking at how we build a community understanding and community education programs around what restorative justice looks like, right? Like, we can talk about abolition all day long, but until everyone can have, like, where we can all be on the same page and on equal footing in regards to understanding what victim-led restorative justice and mediation practices look like, we're all gonna be envisioning slightly different futures, right? So I think part of that work is both engaging and informing the community around what some of these processes look like, and then having those community conversations and those town halls to understand, like, okay, now we all have a base level of what this vision might look like. How are we all going to come together and get on the same page as to what we want as a community in regards to certain situations, right? So starting to have those community conversations now, right, before we've even dismantled the prison system, like, we one day will, like, we need to be looking at how we're going to deal with the fact that, like, even without the police, we don't want everyone to become a cop, right? Like, we don't want everyone to be in a position of policing each other, but we do want to have an understanding that, like, harm is still going to happen. And we're still going to need to have a way to respond to that. And once we can start having community agreed upon like standards for how we want to approach that, I think it makes the work a little bit easier of, like, starting to push elected officials towards this vision in that means of harm reduction, right? Like, as said, I don't think that, like, electeds are going to be what saves us or are going to be the people who sign the paper to say, like, yes, demolish these prisons. Like, that's not the world that we see. But when we can start proposing solutions for saying, like, we don't need the police or this jail because do this instead, we're going to start, like, turning the tide in public opinion and starting to be able to mobilize more people to an abolitionist framework.
Yeah, I'll just add a couple extra thoughts. I mean, I personally think that white folks need to tell other white folks to stop moving here. And I think white folks need to sell their houses for under market value to black and brown folks. Yeah. Like, I think that's just, like, an easy one, but, like, the right one. I think that, like, there's things like that where I'm just, like, stop using, like, your, like, I don't know, your queerness to justify moving into Alberta neighborhood and buying houses. I can talk a book separately about that, but I'm just saying, like, you know, you are not an exception. And I think white folks need to know that. I think we can build more of that understanding. I think we can stop our friends from calling the cops and build up our understanding of the impact that happens when we do. So I think, like, dismantling our reliance, building up our education. So part of that for me is, like, does everyone know, like, about Measure 11 and, like, mandatory minimum sentencing, right? Like, so you might be like, oh, a cop will come and maybe they'll mitigate it and, like, whatever. But, like, actually, like, if someone gets arrested and charged, like, there are minimum sentences for people that can't be made better by a kind judge, you know? So I think there's things like that that we, like, feel, I think we're being irresponsible with not knowing more about. Maybe irresponsible is too big because we've all been taught to believe certain things, but I think we have a responsibility, I guess what I'm saying, to know more. I would echo transformative justice. I think the following piece today around pod mapping is so critical, right? Because I think what we can build is relationships, and we have so much control and power in doing that, and we can build our networks to be so defined to know, like, who are we gonna call when someone harms us? Who do we want called when someone harms us? And also, who do we want called when we harm? And when we do that, right? We will all harm. If we haven't already, we will. That is gonna happen in our lives. And I think that there's, like, other things that are, you know, simpler, more tangible. Like, does everyone have a medical kit in your car that you could have available to, like, you know, support someone with instead of calling the cops or a first responder when it doesn't actually require that? Do you have a skill set already to know how to de-escalate someone who may only need a calm presence in their life to move through a moment where they don't actually need the intervention of someone else. So I think that there are actually much smaller things that we all can do like today in the next 24 hours. But I think I think one of the pieces that I've become more clear in this work is that it feels overwhelming to know where to start. And I would just encourage us to like even just start with having a conversation with someone else in your life about like, what could we do? What should we do? And that kind of partnership and dialogue, I think, is where I would encourage people to start if they haven't already, to start thinking about this, because it is overwhelming. But we have models. We've had models. We know what it looks like to live in a world without police because we've done it. We can do it. Wealthy people do that all the time,
yes.
Right? So we already know that it's possible. It's just about thinking about how we're going to build towards that ourselves. Oh, one last thing. If you, sorry.
No, you're fine.
Yeah, I would just say, if you haven't watched Bastards of the Party, I think I think it's on Netflix still. It's a movie that showcases like the history of gangs. So if you're walking out of here being like, oh, I don't even know how to like really think about gangs, I just think that's a really tangible way. Like, watch that movie. It really talks about how the state has used gangs to have black and brown people kill each other. And how it's been a manufacture. Gangs have been manufactured by the state. So
there's been a ton of resources thrown out. I don't want to miss an opportunity to just address this quickly if possible, but you know, what are some ways folks can immediately, you know, start to mobilize with each organization representing?
Decrim Oregon has a little table over there. We've got little handouts, and you can come, like there's a link to a form on the back where you can fill it out and tell us like how you're looking to get engaged, and we can like sort of build off of that. So come grab one of those pamphlets if you're looking to get involved with Decrim. Camille's over there.
Don't Shoot Portland is having an expungement clinic on the 20th of this month, so you can share the word with people in communities that might need that access, and it's open to everyone in the state of Oregon. It's being paid for by cannabis tax dollars also as a part of a pilot, and we were the first agency referred for this, so we want to make a good outcoming, and we want to give people a space where they won't be like interrogated because they're coming to get this information. So let them know it'll be at our office on the 20th. And I believe that Cindy brought some flyers, so I'll leave some here. You can get more information on DontShootPDX.org.
RAP, the Western Regional Advocacy Project, is a private coalition. I don't know how to say it. The membership requirements are really steep. However, volunteering for RAP is through volunteering for the member organizations. So here in Oregon, in Portland, it's Right to Survive, Street Roots, and the Sisters of the Road, who are founding members. Sisters is always accepting volunteers. We're open Tuesday to Saturday from 10 until 2:30. We have a large variety of things that could be done all day long. I do warn you, it is real there. It is very intense. There's a lot of trauma on the streets daily, and that trauma is all in one place in Old Town, and it's at our restaurant, which is also coincidentally one of the busiest restaurants in downtown. So it can be a little overwhelming, but it's also good work. It's fulfilling. You can make a lot of relationships there and meet a lot of the community. Another way is we just started a campaign called Stop the Sweeps, which isn't quite open yet. It will be soon. It's mostly just kind of organizers right now, but when we do open it up, we invite everybody to be a part of it. It's a coalition formed around stopping the sweeps in the variety of ways. Right to Survive is also, of course, looking for volunteers, as always. I did want to say one thing before I stop, though. And that's that there is a rise in private policing, which is not talked about very often, but heavily affects the houseless community. There is a variety of contractors across the city, from rapid response to positive action to teams with Central City to, well, they don't do sweeps, but there's a large variety of teams that go around the city and essentially just remove homeless people. There's like no accountability structures for these things. So just keep an eye out for private police, right, security teams, because they get away with a lot of stuff, and they're starting to take the bulk of enforcement away from the police, because that's expensive, and shifting it into the private sector. Yeah, it sucks. Just keep your eyes open.
I mean, y'all are here, so obviously you've engaged with our work in some way, and so I would encourage you to keep doing that, and get on our list if possible. And we are this year integrating more, we have more volunteer roles than we ever have had, especially as we lead into the budget cycle. So I think that's gonna be a really critical place to support our work, is that we need to show the city in numbers that we will continue to demand the police to not spend money, or the Portland City Council and the mayor to no longer spend money on the police. And so we've had some wins, and I know we will continue to have wins, and that is greatly impacted by folks showing up with us, and that can be a really tangible way to show up and turn out. So I'm sure we'll share more at the end of today as well about how to get more involved, but I would just say, like, follow us on Instagram, sign up, be there at one of the city council hearings, sign up to, you know, print things off and help with childcare and all the moving pieces, right? Like, we certainly need the support and help.
Awesome. On behalf of hopefully a lot of folks in this room, I want to extend a deep appreciation for all of the work these organizations are doing. So if we can just give it up to them.
Yes.